I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The leader of the New Jersey State Senate says Atlantic City will go bankrupt if lawmakers don't agree soon on legislation to deal with its financial crisis. Here's WHYY's Phil Gregory.
Senate President Steve Sweeney wants the Assembly to vote on his legislation to give the city 130 days to reduce costs before the state would intervene. But Assembly Speaker Vinny Prieto wants to give the city 2 years to make improvements. Sweeney says if the Assembly approves Prieto's version, he won't allow a Senate vote because Governor Christie would reject it.
The politics of this is really upsetting to watch Atlantic City flounder, to see the taxpayers in that city that are going to be the people that are going to be harmed down there. There's people that are going to lose jobs.
Sweeney says the deadlock has already hurt the city's convention business. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey is under attack in his reelection bid for helping his party block President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee. National Democrats are especially targeting Toomey because they believe a win in Pennsylvania increases their odds of recapturing the Senate in November. WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports.
6 years ago, Pat Toomey won his U.S. Senate race by a mere 2 points in a year where Republicans saw major gains nationwide. Democrats have their eyes set on his seat in this cycle, and they're doing all they can to help out his opponent, Katie McGinty. This week, Toomey is getting hit with ads as a part of an effort to force Republicans to relent and fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. The White House-aligned Constitutional Responsibility Project is rolling out a campaign dubbed 999, 9 states in 9 days, to push for a ninth justice, or in this case, the president's nominee, Merrick Garland. You may have seen this TV ad playing this week.
The Constitution says the president shall make nominations for the Supreme Court and the Senate votes, no exception for election years. Why is Pat Toomey refusing to do the job Pennsylvania elected him to do? Toomey refuses to consider anyone President Obama nominates.
The group is promising to hold 50 events in 9 states during this week's congressional recess. The pressure campaign may be why Toomey is reluctant to discuss the Supreme Court vacancy these days.
I think we put out a statement. I think I made it pretty clear.
Toomey recently met with Judge Garland, and he went farther than many Republicans who merely argue the next president should fill the vacancy. In the hallway outside his office, Toomey told a scrum of reporters he fears Garland would merely rubber stamp the Obama administration on cases ranging from EPA climate regulations to executive actions on immigration.
Based on a number of decisions and my conversation with Judge Garland, I'm not convinced that he would be willing to play the role of a sufficiently aggressive check on an administration.
The GOP is still reeling from the unexpected death of conservative judicial icon Justice Antonin Scalia. Toomey says the stakes are high in this election.
I think everybody would acknowledge that, including Judge Garland, that Judge Garland is not going to be Justice Scalia. That they are two very different men, they have two very different views, they have two very different approaches. And so necessarily it's the case that if he were to be put on the court, it would change the balance of the court.
The stakes are high for Democrats, too. At a recent press conference, Democratic leaders were asked specifically about Toomey's seat. In response, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid pulled the veil back on his party's strategy in November. They see the vacancy as a winning wedge issue.
I was shown yesterday, and some of my colleagues were, an actual poll that was taken in Ohio, in-depth poll by one of America's great pollsters. And clearly it's having an impact in Ohio, and I bet Pennsylvania is no different. I mean, how could it not? I mean, people believe we're here to do a job.
Those targeted polls against vulnerable incumbents are only a harbinger of things to come, especially with Donald Trump as the GOP's presumptive nominee. Pennsylvania's other senator, Democrat Bob Casey, says pressure is building from the ground up because most voters are only catching on now about how long the vacancy might last. He says recently his office received some 6,000 pieces of mail or emails in favor of acting on Garland. Casey says he doesn't understand why Republicans won't debate his party openly over Garland and the future of the court.
And if you want to be against him or criticize him or say he's X, Y, or Z, go ahead. You know, the First Amendment is still in effect, so you can do whatever you want in terms of criticizing and how you vote, but don't deny him a hearing and a vote.
The court is dealing with the vacancy by dropping some casework. It's also expected to leave big issues hanging, as the justices are now more prone to 4-4 ties. As for Toomey, he doesn't seem worried about the stacks of casework piling up at the court or the attacks he's getting from the left. He says he's also hearing from conservatives who support his position on Garland.
He comes up.
What do people...
Opinions run the gamut.
The high court vacancy, which could remain open until next spring, makes November's elections all the more important, because you not only get to vote on the next president and the makeup of Congress, but it looks like you'll get a say in the makeup of the Supreme Court, too. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
This weekend, Philadelphia will join other cities across the country and around the world sponsoring Jane's Walk 2016 events. Let's learn more about Jane Jacobs, born 100 years ago this week, her legacy, and her impact on urban planning with Ashley Hahn from Plan Philly, which is presenting the city's series of what are being termed roving conversations. Ashley, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Why don't we start with the focus on Jane Jacobs and her legacy?
Jane Jacobs is, by all accounts, still as current as she was in 1961 when she wrote the book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. She was and is such a profound influence on the state of urban planning and the way we think about cities. She came into the spotlight in a moment when cities were undergoing a lot of urban renewal, a lot of top-down planning. And in the process, she witnessed neighborhoods getting raised and with that, all the great things that make cities live, all the texture and the mix of uses and the great diversity and what she called the sidewalk ballet, the stuff that animates city life.
Specifically, in this case, Greenwich Village.
She was fighting against an expressway that was about to be built basically through her neighborhood. And so there was this great battle between Jane Jacobs, civic activist, and Robert Moses, master planner.
Who won?
Jacobs won. And in the hearts of many, she's still the winner. We're undoing Moses-era projects and those like them all across the country today, tearing down expressways and trying to re-knit back together cities in ways that make them walkable and livable. And that's Jane Jacobs all over.
To what extent did she focus on Philadelphia?
In her book, she used Philadelphia's four original squares as case examples of the life of parks. So she visits our four squares, Rittenhouse, Logan, Franklin, and Washington, to explore what makes parks successful or not.
Of course, those parks in that time were different than they are now.
That's right. She calls out Washington Square as the pervert park. She calls out Franklin Square as a Skid Row park. Rittenhouse Square, by contrast, was exactly as we know it today. A lot of the buildings surrounding it are similar, and a lot of the uses are similar. It's about a mixture of uses that help make these places successful as urban public spaces.
Let's listen now to Doris Finelli weighing in on Washington Square. She serves as Chief of Cultural Resources Management at Independence National Historical Park.
The users have changed radically over time. All of these buildings around here were commercial buildings at one time, and the lunch crowd was here, and they went home at the end of the day. Now, all of these buildings are going condo. And so we have a more residential use, which actually goes back before the commercial uses. It was residential. So it's kind of going back to the future in that sense.
Ashley, you cited Jane as an activist in her day, but the effort to preserve and maintain, say, Washington Square is also done at the municipal government level.
It's actually the federal government level. So the National Park Service has an agreement with the City of Philadelphia to manage that space. They see it as very closely tied to Independence, and so that's why they took over managing it. They're also very aware that it's a real urban public space used by everyday Philadelphians all the time.
Why don't we next hear from Amy Needle on Franklin Square. She serves as president and CEO of Historic Philadelphia.
All of the lighting was broken. The gorgeous fountain in the center hadn't worked since the bicentennial. The playground that was there, each day the daycare center teachers who use it on a daily basis would come over in the morning and clean out the needles and drug paraphernalia that were left from the night before so that the kids could play. It was a very sad place.
Not so sad anymore, and that's thanks to a public-private partnership.
Historic Philadelphia has managed Franklin Square for the last 10 years, and they've really worked hard to make it a place that people want to go to by putting in attractions that draw people there. The mini golf, and there's the carousel, and then just open space.
Okay, I've laced up my walking shoes. Let's go on one of these roving conversations. How does that work?
It is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, May 6th to 8th. Anybody can sign up to lead a walk. It is organized around the principle of citizen expertise, sharing what you know about your neighborhood and your community, and taking advantage of the opportunity to walk and talk out loud about what you want from your city. How does this place work? What would I want from it?
Ashley Hahn, thanks so much. Hope it's a great weekend.
Thanks, Dave.
Ashley Hahn from Plan Philly will have a listing of the schedule of planned walks on our website, newsworks.org, where you can also hear much more of our conversation. Still ahead, thanks to cyberspace, bullying is on the rise. It can lead to depression, even suicide. But sometimes the consequences can go in a different direction.
I became the person you didn't want to mess with. I had no regard for people's feelings. I became the bully.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. For many students, the transition to middle school can be tough. The pressure to be popular and fit in can become a higher priority than the math homework due the next day, and that kind of pressure can lead to bullying. The problem, in person and online, has grown to crisis levels, prompting the United Nations to name today Anti-Bullying Day, encouraging all to take a stand against such behavior. Amanda Thew, a high school senior at Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia, is speaking out about her experience in middle school, being bullied, and becoming a bully herself.
On the first day at my new school, I felt overwhelmed, thinking that people were staring at me, making judgments about the way I looked. But later in art class, the popular kids asked me to sit down with them. That's how it all began. I started to hang out with my new friends on the weekends at an ice rink in South Philly. I met other kids from nearby schools who did things that were inconceivable to me. Some were drinking, smoking, and having sex at age 13. I still hadn't had my first kiss. But being with a big group of people outside of school made me feel like I was really a part of something. To keep up with them, I created a facade. I stuffed my double A cup bra with tissues. I wore makeup, curled my hair like a Barbie doll. I became a compulsive liar. The people I thought were my friends started to treat me differently. I'm an Asian American, so I encountered racial slurs. One classmate asked if I ate dog and started to mock the Chinese language with gibberish and noise. I was told that my school uniform looked cheap. My socks were too baggy above my beaten-up Converses. My hair was greasy, my teeth imperfect. They called me a box-shaped dwarf because my torso was shortened by scoliosis. I became depressed and thought about suicide just so the bullying would end. Instead, I became the person you didn't want to mess with. My language had no filter. I had no regard for people's feelings. I became the bully. It took me to the top of the food chain, and it felt great. In eighth grade, two new girls came into our class. One had a speech impediment, and the other was mixed race. I pretended to be their friend to show them the ropes, but really I wanted to show them that I was the boss. I saw these girls as my targets, my chance to terrorize someone. I moved my abuse to Facebook, posting rude comments under their photos, making fun of their poses and their outfits. I posted that I wanted to give the mixed race girl a makeover so she could be prettier, and I said she was annoying and weird. A guy in my friend group made a Facebook post saying he hated the girl with a speech impediment, and he tagged her in it. I liked the post because I thought it was funny. The next day, everyone who liked the post got called down to the principal's office. The girl felt humiliated and hurt, and her mother was upset too. In that moment, I knew I wasn't being myself. I remember how the popular kids made me feel when I was the new kid, treating me like their friend only to turn on me. I had become exactly like them. I couldn't be that person. I'm finally speaking out on something I've been afraid to tell people for many years, and I want to apologize to those two girls. If you ever encounter bullying, speak up. No more making each other feel inferior. No more taking each other down because we're different. Everyone we know deserves to feel safe and accepted. Being on both ends of bullying is an experience I would never forget, and I hope that the story helps people realize the damage that bullying causes. These traumatic experiences stay with you for a lifetime. Let's end them now.
Amanda Thew's essay can be found at newsworks.org. The piece was produced by Jeanette Woods. Once upon a time, between the era of dry goods emporiums and the current world of Walmart, retail was driven by department stores. In the Philadelphia area, think John Wanamaker's, Gimbel Brothers, and a nearby Allentown, Hess's. Let's go shopping with Hartwick College Associate History Professor Dr. Vicki Howard, author of From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. Vicki, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. I'm happy to be here.
This is indeed an historical account at the nexus of industry, transportation, technology, economic transportation, urban planning. What was your entree point into this brief era of retailing?
You mean besides liking shopping?
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Well, I did a book on the wedding industry and a lot of research on department stores because department stores played a big role with the rise of gift registries and bridal salons. And so I got to see a lot of records of department stores across the country, and I just found them very interesting social institutions.
Well, let's talk about it then as a social institution. How did it come about?
Many of the department stores that became, you know, household names, like some of the ones you mentioned that are from Pennsylvania, got their start either as dry goods stores, you know, specialty stores featuring, you know, one line of goods. Some of them were wholesalers and then became retailers. And so they evolved by adding different departments. Maybe they sold dry goods and then they added on other kinds of furnishings. And eventually, you know, they found they needed to run their business differently than they had when they were just a single line merchant.
That
today.
Proto-early era, does that date back to the 19th century?
Yes. One of the big early prototypes of the department store is A.T. Stewart's in New York City. And it was a major departmentalized dry goods store. It didn't sell many, many lines of goods. Like the department stores, when they start developing in their mature form in the 1870s, 1880s.
When was the heyday of the department store?
Well, the heyday of the big urban, big city department stores is the late 19th century. But I think that if you want to think about it, department stores spreading across the country to, you know, so every town and small city, as well as the large cities, has one around 1900, early 20th century. That was the case. And they were, you know, major social institutions all the way through the first half of the 20th century. And that didn't start to change until World War II, and then with sort of a decentralization movement. Markets are moving out of the city center, and stores start chasing suburban shoppers. You get the rise of shopping malls.
Was the name identification with, say, John Wanamaker's equal to and revered to the same extent as a city's sports team, say the Phillies? In what regard were they held?
Well, you know, somebody like John Wanamaker, you know, who founded, you know, Wanamaker's, you know, in the 1870s, you have his presence with the buildings that he built, their name, and then their store's name become associated with the city, and they become a destination for people who are visiting, but also just in the community, they play a role in decisions that are made in terms of the development of the city and where the shopping is going to be. So they play a pretty big civic role and influential role in terms of the development of a city.
And in general, there is a now nostalgia for Wanamaker's or Hess's. Is it for the store in particular or a bygone era?
Probably both, and that's a good question. You have Macy's now is in the Wanamaker building. It still exists as a destination for downtown in Philadelphia to shop at. And I know that, you know, you can still see the Eagle there and the Oregon there. But by many accounts, it's not in the same sort of glory and luxury as it once was. There's been a lot of standardization and homogenization in retailing. And I think that's what people are lamenting. These places that were maybe more diverse and more heterogeneous and more vibrant are now more standardized and more corporate.
Dr. Howard, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hartwick College Associate History Professor Dr. Vicki Howard, author of From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. She will be speaking about her book at the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington tomorrow evening. And you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Finally this evening, happy Star Wars Day! Nope, it's not the anniversary of any of the release dates of the iconic series of films. And it's not creator George Lucas's birthday. Today is May the 4th, which is celebrated by Star Wars enthusiasts when they say, "May the Force be with you." Yeah, a little twist on the film's famous phrase, "May the Force be with you." Truth be told, Star Wars fans didn't introduce the often quoted phrase. Britain elected its first female prime minister, Margaret Thatcher, in 1979. And on May 4th of that year, the day she took office, the Conservative Party placed an ad in the London Evening News which read, "May the Fourth be with you, Maggie. Congratulations." That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.